Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopton Hay. My guest is Tanya Golaz Boza. She is the author of Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap. Tanya is the executive director of the University of California Washington Center and a professor of sociology at the University of California, Merced. She is the author of five books that engage with issues such as racism, immigration policy, human rights, and race in Latin America. And Tanya, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you, Hopton. It's great to be here.
So Tanya, why don't you start off with giving an overview of what Before Gentrification is all about?
Great. So the title says it all. The title is Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap. So what I set out to understand in this book is how did the nation's capital come to be a city that could be gentrified? And the reason why that's an important question to ask is gentrification doesn't happen in well-resourced neighborhoods, right? Gentrification only happens in neighborhoods that are low resource, low income, lack of resources. Gentrification means putting more money into a neighborhood, but only into neighborhoods that are disinvested, low income. So I had to ask the question, you know, how did the nation's capital get to a point where it could be one of the most heavily gentrified neighborhoods in the city? And what that did is it took me back to really understanding the history of majority Black neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. And that in turn gave me insight into how and why Black families in Washington, D.C. have not been able to accumulate wealth in the same way that white families have been able to accumulate wealth.
Now, you grew up in Washington, D.C., so this is not just you speaking as an academic that lives 1,000 miles away. This is speaking as someone that grew up in a Black, predominantly Black neighborhood in Washington, D.C. As an academic, how did that inform the way you presented the book as opposed to if you lived and grew up in a whole totally different community?
Yeah, so what's interesting about being an academic is, you know, you read the studies, you understand the communities, you understand national trends, but every so often you learn something and you think, you know, like that doesn't resonate with my experience. And that's when as an academic, that's where the gold is, because it's when you find something that everyone thinks to be the case, and then there's something like that's not what happened in my community. Let me look into that, see what happened. That's when sometimes you can really develop new ways of thinking about the world. So in this particular case, as I was thinking about, you know, as I was reading the literature on gentrification, for example, and most people say, you know, gentrification doesn't tend to happen in majority Black communities. And I was like, well, in DC, the only communities that were gentrified were those that were majority Black. So that got me thinking, why is that? What makes DC different? Other things is when we talk about the war on drugs, you know, that time period between like 1985, 1995, a lot of academics will say that primarily affected very low income Black communities. But the neighborhood that I grew up in was a middle class Black community, and it was very heavily affected by the war on drugs. So that also got me thinking, you know, what are some ways that the war on drugs also affected Black middle class communities? And finally, there's a lot of people that will say that Black people were locked out of home ownership opportunities in the post-World War II era. But the neighborhood that I grew up in, which was majority Black, it was also half of the population was homeowners, right? So there were a lot of Black homeowners in that neighborhood. So again, I was thinking, well, why is it that people were able to purchase homes in this neighborhood? But then why did that not lead to wealth accumulation? So lots of little things, like lots of little insights that I get from that, and that doesn't resonate with my experience.
What really caught my attention among the many things, but the one thing that I kind of never really thought of, and you write that disinvestment and then carceral investment, meaning investment in the prison system and police, et cetera, enabled gentrification through racialized reinvestment. And you tell a lot of stories, some from people you actually grew up with. And one of the things that you pointed out in one of the stories, you talked about asset forfeiture, and how a home that was in a family, a house for generations, was lost because one of the people was arrested for selling drugs. And through the the process of asset forfeiture, they lost the house. And it sort of leads into sort of going from upward mobility, because you saw Black families going from upward mobility, that generation, homeowners, making a good living, to generations further down, losing a house and going downward economically. Talk specifically about that example.
Yeah, one thing as I was writing this book and thinking about, I was reflecting on the fact that the neighborhood I grew up in, the majority of my friends lived in the homes with their grandparents, with their grandmother and grandfather. And I had never really thought about it, but I was like, wait a second, their grandparents purchased these homes in the 1950s, like pre-civil rights. I'm like, that is pretty remarkable, right? To be an African American, in the very early stages of the civil rights movement, just after Brown versus Board of Education, there's still lots of barriers. There's still a lot of overt discrimination. And these Black people in Washington, D.C., tens of thousands of them were able to purchase homes. And I was like, well, that's very incredible, right? For them to have been able to do that. But let's hone in on one story just to kind of drive the point home. So looking into the history of one person that I knew that I grew up with, I found out that her grandfather in the 1950s purchased three properties, right? Like, wow, like he's, obviously a very enterprising man. He figured things out. He purchased these three properties. And I'm sure, I never met him. I never had the chance to meet him, but I'm sure that he imagined that this would be his legacy, that this would be what he would pass down, along to in his generation, to his subsequent generations. Unfortunately, he ended up losing two of the houses, but he kept one. And the house that he kept was in a very nice neighborhood, central to the city, close to the park, very beautiful, large house. And he raised his three children in that house. And then his children, in turn, one of his daughters, in turn, raised her grandchildren in that house. And then the next generation was also coming up in that house. But in 1993, by 1993, there were the grandmother was living there, the mother, the kids, basically four generations in the house. But the police came and raided the house, and they alleged that one of the grandkids, because he was selling cocaine, that he was selling cocaine out of that house, and then they forfeited the house, and that's the story that I open up with. So this generations of work, of effort, of planning was just taken away in with the legal, stroke of the pen. So that's the under the asset forfeiture laws, which were very strict, very punitive in that time. If the federal government could establish that any drug activity was being conducted out of that house, then they could forfeit the house. And in this particular case, the grandson no longer lived in the house, but somehow they were able to establish, and they actually took the home from this family.
Wow. So, you also, as you talked about earlier, you talked about the growth in the book of home ownership in the Black community in Washington, D.C., how it increased sevenfold between 1940 and 1980. You also talked about public housing initially providing safe and comfortable homes for Black people. My wife grew up in New York City, and she lived in public housing there for a while. Her family. I lived in public housing in New Orleans and from 1970 to 1976. So when you talk about public housing, that's something that I have a personal affiliation with. But you also talk about how the move to demolish housing and to demolish public housing and what it made me think about. You talk about, I believe, the Capitol Views and what happened there with the public housing in those neighborhoods. Is when you demolish public housing, you say you're going to use a HOPE-6 grant, which is a grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, where they promote sort of these mixed income communities and retail, and they have these big ideas on what can happen. But a thought crossed my mind, and you sort of capture this in the narrative, which is where do the people go as they wait for the new housing to be developed? Oftentimes, it's not one-to-one replacement. You know, they say we're going to reserve X percent of the new housing for low-income families. And then one of the examples, and correct me if I'm wrong, not only did was it not one-to-one replacement, but they had higher income requirements for that new low-income housing as compared to the medium or average household income for people who were living there. And so it's almost like if they do it the way they do it, and this is the HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, is supposed to create jobs and opportunities for people in those communities. So let me underline this term, people in those communities. And so what so often happens is people in those communities, some of them get displaced, many of them get displaced, and then it becomes a great target for gentrification.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens in neighborhood after neighborhood in Washington, D.C. is, first of all, you have these public housing. And one thing that I just want to stress, because not everybody knows this, because public housing got a really bad reputation in the 1980s and 1990s. When it was first built, it was built for working people, and it was nice. Like many of these public housing places in Washington, D.C. were decent housing for working families. But what happened, though, is in the 1970s, Richard Nixon decided that the federal government was no longer going to be investing money into public housing. And they said, basically public housing, it's already built, and the rents that are collected, that's going to be what sustains it. So we're not going to put any more money into public housing. So and once they did that, and then they lowered the income requirements so that now people that were very low income were living there, and then, which is good in terms of them getting housing. But the problem is that now they're also only paying a small percentage of their income, and their income is very low. So they're paying very little, $100 a month or so to live in the public housing. And that's not enough to maintain it. So the public housing becomes dilapidated over time. And by the end of the 20th century, many of the public housing just became extremely dilapidated, run down. So then the solution becomes, okay, well, obviously that didn't work out. We're going to have to demolish it. So the HUD, Housing Urban Development, and the government agency that runs public housing, they decide that they're going to demolish these units and build a mixed income affordable housing in its place. But there's the two problems with that are, first of all, they demolish it and it takes a couple years to rebuild it up again. So that means that all the people that are living there have to go live somewhere else for a couple years. And not only do they then have to re-qualify to get back into the new building, but also a lot of them don't qualify, because now it's mixed, it's housing for people that make, in DC, 30% of the area median income, which is $40,000 a year. But when they demolished Navy Yard, the average income was only $8,000. Like, these are very low income people. So they don't qualify for the new housing. You also have to pass credit checks, et cetera, to get into these new housing. So a lot of, basically a very small percentage of the long-term public housing residents were able to move into the mixed income communities.
Well, I want to bring up this use of market type of solutions to problems that I'm a capitalist. You don't have any love for capitalism, so understand that completely. But so often, going back to Nixon, number one, the expectation that we're going to make this public housing pay for itself is utterly ridiculous. It's almost like setting it up to fail. Like, there's such an opposition to investments for the good of the community that don't have to provide a market rate. So I am interested in that, because often I'm, like I said, I'm a capitalist, but I'm probably progressive. I'm progressive, and it's okay to subsidize poor people, I guess is my point. When did it become such a bad thing to subsidize the needs of poor people, who often, and this is where you and I will agree, the structure of the economy and lack of opportunities is often why they don't have the success that others who have so many other resources to help them to succeed financially, career-wise, education-wise.
Yeah, and I think if you look at Washington, D.C., what you'll see today is that it's a thriving economy, right? But it's really only thriving for people that have a college degree. So in Washington, D.C., the unemployment rate for whites is very low. It's like 2%. Where for Black people, it's 10%. So it's five times higher. And so that has to do with the fact that a lot of Black people in Washington, D.C. do not have a college education. A lot of them do. We have a lot of very professional, very highly educated Black people, but we have a large cohort of Black people that have not graduated high school and have not graduated college. And one of the main reasons for that is that Black neighborhoods in the 1980s and 1990s were disinvested. The schools were failing. Teachers weren't showing up to school. There's all kinds of problems. So the environment wasn't conducive for people to graduate. So those people who are today in their 40s and 50s that don't have a college education, it's very difficult for most of them to earn enough money to pay rent in the city, right? Because if you don't have a college education, you're going to be making $15, $16, $17 an hour. And that is not enough to afford any housing in the city, except for, heavily subsidized housing, which is in very limited supply. So what we see today is this interesting scenario where the city needs transit workers, we need construction workers, we need people that work at Starbucks, people that work at CVS, and all of those people make, between $15 and $25 an hour. And that is not enough to afford even a one bedroom apartment, much less an apartment for a family. So we've kind of like let go. And so that's new. Like in the 80s, if you worked a full-time job, even at minimum wage, you could afford an apartment. But today you can't. So somehow I don't know how the city thinks, and this is not unique to DC, it's all over the country. Like, how are cities going to sustain themselves without workers? And how are workers going to live in the city if they don't have housing? So that has emerged as sort of it's a market problem in many ways. So whether you're a capitalist or not, you can see that that is a problem. If people can't afford to live in the city, how is the city going to get its workers?
I want to talk a bit about education. And you talk about Black students in DC experiencing the ravages of disinvestment before and after schools were desegregated in 1954. And as a result, the parents started to consolidate parents group to demand an end to legal segregation. And you talk specifically about this neighborhood where the students had to travel, Black students had to travel several miles away to attend an overcrowded junior high school, Brown Junior High School, even as a white junior high school was being opened in the neighborhood. As a result, the parents of Spotswood T. Bowling and others sued the Board of Education in DC. And I never knew this. It became Bowling versus Sharp became a companion case to Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. So talk a little bit about the impact of a lack of investment in the educational system for Black students and ensuring that through integration that there was still good investment in those communities' educational system.
Yeah, so the Black community fought very hard for desegregation in Washington, D.C., and they were successful along, as part of this nationwide movement to desegregate schools. So what happened in Washington, D.C. is that schools were legally segregated before 1954. And then in 1954, that school year, Black students could attend the schools of their choice, as well as white students. But what happened in D.C. is that white students who were attending schools that became integrated the following year, almost all of them left the neighborhood or the city, right? So you literally have schools that were 100% white in the 1953 school year, and the 1954 school year they were 100% Black, like literally 100% turnover. You see that in several elementary schools. When you get up to the high schools, the transition was a little slower. So the student the families who had students in like Roosevelt High School, Coolidge High School, which were all white in 1953, many of those white parents kept their kids in school, and those schools actually became integrated. So Roosevelt High and Coolidge High became integrated schools in 1954. Now by 1960, they were almost 100% Black. So the integration took a little, sorry, it went from segregated to integrated to segregated again in a few years as opposed to like overnight. So we look at a school like Roosevelt High. Roosevelt High is in the neighborhood where I grew up. It was a white middle class neighborhood in the 1950s. And by the 1960s, it had become a Black middle class neighborhood. And Roosevelt High in the 1960s, by that time, it had become almost all Black. It continued to provide an excellent education to students. It had a stellar honors program. Many of the graduates of that time period went on to become leaders of the city in the future. They went off to excellent colleges. They went to Howard, they went to Harvard, they went to MIT. They all, many of those students did very well. throughout the 1960s. So I do want to emphasize that after desegregation, even though now we have de jure, we have like de facto segregation instead of de jure segregation, the schools were still excellent. But what happened is once the schools desegregated and we had white flight from the city, the number of Black people that moved to the city increased significantly, and the number of Black students in the school system increased significantly. We went from 100,000 students in the DC public school system in 1954 to 150,000 by 1970. I'm sorry, by 1960. But then the funding didn't increase. So we see this slow disinvestment in schools. So Roosevelt was a great school in the 50s, really good school in the 60s. By the 70s, it started to really show this the signs of lack of investment. By the 1990s, Roosevelt was a failing school, like by all accounts. Students were not graduating, students were not passing the AP exams. There were shootings at the school. There was violence, there was fights on the yard every day. So the school gradually deteriorated in quality, but not because it became majority Black, but because it became disinvested over time.
I'm a product of the war on poverty and the Great Society. And I will tell you, living in the housing projects for 6 years and having access to all those programs, starting in ninth grade, a job working at the junior high school library because of federal funding, a job working at the City of New Orleans Public Library because of federal funding, attending Upward Bound at Xavier University of Louisiana because of federal funding. So I reaped the benefits of the war on poverty and the Great Society. I guess that was really war on poverty under the LBJ administration, Lyndon Baines Johnson, president administration. And the run away from subsidizing programs like these, while at the same time, something that I sort of became aware of, that no one ever talks about the subsidy that middle, upper middle class families get from the federal government by being able to write off your mortgage interest expense. I mean, a huge subsidy for upper middle class family and helps to support the housing industry. So talk a little bit about the importance, as you say over and over again, the importance these communities decline because of lack of investment, whether investment in education, investment in jobs, and the other thing, and I know I'm going off on a tangent here, is the jobs went to the suburbs. The housing went to the suburbs. The building of these highways to make it possible for people to go back and forth to the suburbs. The jobs went to the suburbs, and there was just significant underinvestment in the low to moderate income communities or communities that became low to moderate income communities.
Yeah, and I think if you look, we go back to this neighborhood where Roosevelt is, the broader neighborhood is called Petworth. So if you look at Petworth in the 1950s, it's majority white. There is small businesses everywhere. The schools are excellent. And the people living in that neighborhood are making about the citywide median. So it's not a well-to-do neighborhood, but it's like a solid middle-class neighborhood. Yeah, police officers, teachers, construction workers, et cetera. Fast forward to the 1960s, you have the same income profile. Now most of the residents are Black. And there you still have these shops, but they're starting to close down. They're starting to close down kind of one by one. And for example, the ice cream shops closes down, nothing opens in its place because now the neighborhood is majority Black, the banks are not lending money in that neighborhood anymore, right? So the ice cream shop closes, then the department store closes. So over the course of the 1960s and 1970s, all of these kind of small businesses that are giving vibrancy to the neighborhood start to close down. And the only thing that stays open, literally, there's a liquor store on the corner of Fifth and Kennedy. It just closed down during the pandemic, but it had been there since 1954. There's a carryout Chinese restaurant there that has been there since 1954. There's a funeral home that's been there since 1954. So funeral homes, carryout restaurants, corner stores, liquor stores survive, but all the little ice cream shops and sandwich shops, grocery stores, all of those, shut down as the neighborhood becomes majority Black. And I think what's interesting about this story is just keep in mind that the income profile of the neighborhood really hasn't changed. Between like 1950 and 2000, that income profile stays about the same. But what changes is the kinds of investments that are done in the neighborhood, and that changes due to, redlining, the banks are not giving out loans. It's due to the cutback of federal programs. So now there's not programs to enhance the schools, to add extracurricular programs, et cetera. And what that does is it really stifles the opportunities for that generation. So what we see is that there's, instead of upward mobility, which is what we tend to hope for in the United States, like, okay, your parents are teachers and then you hope to become a lawyer, right? You hope to have some upward mobility. Instead, what we see is downward mobility. You have the parents are teachers, the parents are nurses, the parents are architects, and then many of the children end up not finishing high school, getting incarcerated, getting addicted to drugs, because the children don't have the set of opportunities available to them that even their parents had. So we often think of this like racial progress in the United States is moving forward, but there really was a setback in the 1980s with the war on drugs and the serious investment in prisons and policing and lack of investment into communities.
I think somewhere in the book, I don't have it in front of me, you say the white wealth in the DC community is 81 times, 81. This is not a typo.
Not
It's
a typo.
81 times the wealth of black families. And that was from the Color of Money.
Yeah, it was from a study done by William Darity and his colleagues of they did studies in various cities, but they did one study in the Washington metropolitan area and asked people about their assets and came up with this figure that in the Washington metropolitan area, white families have 81 times the wealth of black families. And the reason for that primarily is that the black wealth is so small that there's so little wealth in the black community. But what's very interesting in that report, which I don't go into details in the book, is that a white high school graduate has on average more wealth than a black PhD or lawyer in Washington, D.C.
So talk about the value of intergenerational transfer of wealth, because that's one of the things that has always interested me, having these conversations over the many, many years where people will say, well, my family was left this land and we were able to leverage it, or we bought our house when the value of houses at that point, it only cost us $80,000. Now it's worth, $500,000 or $600,000. There's some things that are going on, whether it's being able to take advantage of buying when the prices are low and take in the equity that comes from the rapid accumulation, the rapid rise of the value of that property. And I've had these conversations where someone will say, well, my father gave us the money for the down payment of our house. My grandfather provided the money for my kids to go to college. You see these intergenerational, and I'm of the opinion that more wealth breeds wealth. And if you don't have access to the wealth, that's why it's so important to me that the government subsidizes, because it is not fair competition.
Exactly. So if you were one of those white families living in Petworth in 1954, and you said, you know what, all the white families are leaving, but we're going to stay. We're going to stay in this house and we're not going to sell it. And that would have, on your, as a white family, that would have been a bad financial decision because the homes in that neighborhood did not increase in value for the next 50 years. But if that same white family said, you know what, all the white families are leaving, black people are coming, we're going to move out to the suburbs, and you bought a home out in the suburbs in 1954, that home would have increased in value exponentially by 2000. So we do have this, in the US, we believe a lot in, home ownership as a legacy for the family. But the problem with that is that if you're white and you buy a home in a primarily white neighborhood, you are likely to reap those benefits over the decades. But if you're black and you bought a home in a majority black neighborhood in 1950, 1960, 1970, 1980, in DC, it was very unlikely to increase in value, beyond the rate of inflation. They do increase, but like it's at the rate of inflation. So you're not reaping those same benefits. So in DC, what we see systematically is that home values increase most significantly when the neighborhood becomes white. So you have to wait for white people to show up for the neighborhoods, for the houses to now increase in value. So of course, so when we look at gentrification anywhere, you might know of a case that, someone has a family and a home in the family for generations and they hold on to it, for 50 years, and then the neighborhood gentrifies, which often means white people, if it's a black neighborhood, often means white people move in, and now the homes increase in value. And that seems like a good thing, but the issue is Wait a second. Like, if you've actually held on to a home for 50 years, that's a lot of, and the home hasn't increased in value. That's you actually losing a lot of money. Like, you're fixing the heater, you're fixing the air conditioning, you're redoing the roof, and you're doing all this, and the asset is not increasing. So now you have to wait, until the magical day that it gentrifies, and then for in order for you to gain money. So what I saw in my neighborhood a lot was, a lot of people sold their homes in the 1990s. They had bought the homes in the 50s. But by the 90s, they're tired of like spending all this money fixing up the houses, et cetera. And there's no way you could have anticipated that those homes were going to eventually increase in value when they did. Because when it happened quickly. So a lot of people held on to homes for a long time, for 30, 40 years, sold them, and then they sold them to investors who then, turned around and made a lot of money. So there is a lot of money to be made in gentrification, but it's often not going to the long-term homeowners.
What is Blockbuster and how does that affect your ability, or how did that affect the transition and changes of Black communities into white communities?
Okay, this is going to get a little bit, I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds here because there was blockbusting in Petworth, but since I wrote the book, I've actually been digging into it a little bit more. And what I've come up with is an interesting story. So in 1950, Petworth was 100% white. So there was no Black people living in the neighborhood. I mean, 99% white, I just want to say, almost no Black people living in the neighborhood. So beginning in the 1950s, Black people began to move into the neighborhood, and there are blocks in Petworth where if you look at the census in 1950, you see that block was 100% white, 80% homeowner. And then you look at the 1960 census, and now the block is 80% Black and still, 75% homeowner. So it's like, how did all those homes get sold so quickly? Like, what happened? Why did everyone on the block come together and just agree we're going to, sell all these homes? And then who was able, and how were Black people able to purchase those homes? So that was the question that I went into this other project with. And what comes up very interesting is there is some block busting going on where there are real estate companies which do like they do today. Now you see these signs that say, "We buy houses for cash." And they'll come, and some people that live in gentrifying neighborhoods, you get calls all the time, "Sell your home to me, sell your home to me." So that was definitely happening. There were realtors in the neighborhood who actually had their offices right in the neighborhood, and they would call, these homeowners and say, "Hey, you really should sell your house. We have a cash offer available to you. We'll buy your house immediately."
Let me jump in here real quick. So if you could define what, so blockbusting is realtors getting people to sell their houses in the anticipation that they're going to be able to flip them for a lot more value in the future. Is that right? Okay, go
Yes.
ahead.
That is what blockbusting is. But when we dug into it, what we found is that happened where realtors are purchasing homes and reselling them. But what we also found is that when you look at the sales transactions, they weren't always reselling them at a profit. So we found some cases, for example, where a realtor would buy a home from a white family and resell it to a Black family. And let's say the realtor buys the home for $5,000 and resells it for $6,000. That would be blockbusting, where they're doing that over and over again for profit and kind of reaping the profits of the neighborhood. But what we found, interestingly, is that a lot of the times the realtor was buying the home from the white family for $5,000 and selling it to a Black family also for $5,000. So we're trying to understand what was going on. Why were they doing that? And what we've come up with is in some ways the realtors were helping the Black families buy the homes because maybe the white families wouldn't sell them to them, or maybe they couldn't get the loans. But what the realtors were doing in this particular neighborhood is they were lending the money to the Black family to buy the home. So they're helping them, but they're also profiting. So it's a sort of interesting balance of, so there's blockbusting going on, but what's really the major trend that we see is that anytime there's a lot of movement of homes, realtors make money and money lenders make money. So that doesn't even need to be nefarious, is what I'm trying to get at. Like, it's just whenever you see rapid turnover of homes, somebody's making money, right? Because the realtors are making money off of the commissions and the lenders are making money off of the interest.
I mean, it's the same as when you're trying to buy a car, a new car, and you read that, oh, we're only going to make $100 of profit selling you the car. The reality is they're trying to get you to buy through their auto loan company, and because they get a fee. There's something that they must be getting to use the auto loan company. So maybe that's how how they make their profits. So let's talk about redlining. You brought up redlining before. So 1977, the Community Reinvestment Act was passed by Congress to make credit available to the entire communities you serve, because banks would literally draw a red line around a neighborhood and say, we will not loan in this neighborhood. And this was supported by the Federal Housing Administration, that did not want the racial makeup of neighborhoods to change. So we had both the private sector and the public sector enforcing, basically through their lending policies, segregation.
Yes, absolutely. So you have, in the very beginning of the word redlining comes from the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which is a government agency, literally drawing maps of different cities and coloring them in red when they have Black people living in certain neighborhoods, and then coloring in green the neighborhoods where white people live, and saying, we will not underwrite loans in those neighborhoods that are colored in red. So then banks won't lend money in those neighborhoods. So we definitely saw that happening, you know, nationwide redlining. And you can look up the redlining maps. You know, they're now publicly available. But what's interesting is that that happened in the 1930s and 1940s, but redlining as an informal practice continued and continues to this day, right? So it kind of has had various permutations. And what we saw in Petworth is it was difficult, even though it became possible for Black families to buy homes, it wasn't easy or straightforward because the neighborhood continues to be redlined. So I think these brokers that came in and bought the homes from white people and resold them to Black people, they were doing that because Black people didn't always have access to the conventional bank lending. So that's what we saw. So that we saw that happening a lot, these unconventional loans happening in the 1960s. But then as we move into the 1970s, okay, so my parents sold the home that they owned a home in a majority Black neighborhood from 1976 to 1985. And they moved a few blocks away in 1985 to a larger home, still in the same neighborhood. But in 1985, they put their home on the market, and 11 people applied to buy that home, and every single one of them got turned down, and every single one of them was Black. So these are 11 people who believed that they had enough assets to purchase a home, and the banks kept denying them the loan. So redlining made it difficult to sell homes in this neighborhood, and it made it difficult to purchase homes in this neighborhood. And that was after the passage of the Community Reinvestment Act. That was in 1985. And then it came to light in 1995. There was a lawsuit against the Chevy Chase Bank, and it came to light that they were actually told their lenders, do not make loans east of Rock Creek Park. So basically, don't make loans in Black neighborhoods. So redlining, even though it was official, even after it was no longer an official practice, even after it was outlawed by the Fair Housing Act, even though after it was, you know, reinforced with the Community Reinvestment Act, it continued. It continued at least, you know, up through 1995 when they had that lawsuit against the Chevy Chase Savings Bank.
And a lot of this information came out through the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, where they had to start collecting data on the race and ethnicity of the people that were applying for loans. You were seeing these huge disparities. And then the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston did a study sometime in the early 1990s that basically found that they couldn't account for all the disparities in rejection rates for loans to the underwriting guidelines or to the credit of the recipient. So, and then, as you said, I mean, just periodically you hear this study, so-and-so was secretly coding applications to make sure that they weren't approving loans to Blacks. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think sometimes we forget that the racialized inequities continue, often undercover.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would be your recommendation to communities that want to try, and let's look at it from a local government perspective, what the city should do, what the county can do? And it's probably more in Texas, at least, it's going to be more the city. What can the cities do to try to sort of balance out the impact of all these different issues that have affected them? Because as you know, as I've talked about, I've kind of personalized this interview because I worked in East Austin from 1992 to 1998. I saw what it was like then. I saw where it is now. That neighborhood is gentrified, completely gentrified, totally different. And so you say it, you know, there's an old saying in our We'll just say it is what it is, but still, from a public policy perspective, what we've seen is that those Black communities are moving further and further out, being pushed further and further out to the northeastern part of the city, the northeastern part of the county, literally watching that population just move because there was a lot of, I guess there was a lot of renters. So you had renters who were forced out because they were renting as the owners of the real estate saw an opportunity to make much more money by not renewing the leases, rental agreements, and selling or developing these properties. What can a city do?
Yes, I think one thing is important to remember. So when I interviewed people who were living in neighborhoods that have been gentrified, who were from neighborhoods that have been gentrified, they're not opposed to gentrification because gentrification just means high-income people moving in, more amenities available in the neighborhood. And people are like, this is great. Like I like the fact that there is a nice restaurant in my neighborhood. I like the fact that there is now like an ice cream shop. There used to be an ice cream shop. It's nice to have one again. So people are not opposed to reinvestment in their neighborhoods. What people are opposed to is communities being displaced. So how do we avoid, displacement of communities? And part of it is by ensuring the availability of affordable housing, and really affordable housing. So you have to look at, so if there's a community that you have in mind that you want this community to be able to stay, okay, how much income is this community making, right? Are they making, I don't know what the minimum wage is in Texas, but are they making, $10 or $15 an hour? And if so, like what could they legitimately afford in rent? And it's probably not, what the rents are in gentrifying neighborhoods, which means that the city has to set aside enough housing for people that make low incomes. And I think it comes down to, in terms of the argument, I mean, the argument I always make is the one I started out at the beginning of this interview, which is that the city needs workers and workers need housing. So the city has to ensure that housing is affordable, right? There's no way around it. People are not going to, it's not sustainable to expect people to drive an hour every day for a minimum wage job because they can't afford to live in the city. They can find a minimum wage job out where they live, right? Because minimum wage jobs are everywhere. Like you when you come to the city, you need to either, if you're going to be having to drive an hour to get into the city, you're going to do that because you're going to be making more money. So unless the so the, something has to give. Either you have to increase wages or you have to make housing more affordable. But you can't just expect people to live in their cars forever or live in their parents' house forever or shack up with, 10 roommates. Like none of that is sustainable in terms of building, the kind of community that we want to build.
Tanya Golaz-Boza, author of Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.